When systems go down, when tickets pile up, and your best tech walks out the door, what does all that really cost you? At CBT Nuggets, we help IT teams stay sharp, confident, and certified with online training that's built for the real world. From cybersecurity to cloud, our expert-led courses help your team close skill gaps before they turn into business risks. Invest in your team. Go to cbtnuggets.com/solutions and unlock training that makes your team sharper and your system stronger.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words from Gramsci, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation and widely available on all podcasting platforms, as well as a few radio stations. So this week, we usually talk about Republicans, but I don't think they're the only monsters out there. And in this particular case, there's a very good reported story from Wired by Taylor Lorenz about the sort of dark money that is reshaping the social media landscape. And that dark money is coming from Democratic Party donors, or people at least aligned with the Democratic Party. And I think that story, and in particular, the kind of, I would say, bonkers and banana pants response of the people that were reported on in that story, it really opens up a lot of questions about what exactly is happening in social media with wider sort of implications for American democracy. So to talk about all this, I'm very pleased to have on Taylor Lorenz, who's a freelance journalist, very well known for her writing on the world of tech and social media. No stranger to controversy, but I would say that this time she has really stirred up the hornet's nest. So first of all, Taylor, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's talk about this Wired piece, just so listeners know where we're coming from. Just basically describe what it is that you found and reported on.
Yeah, so I broke the story of this basically secret political influence scheme that a big Democratic dark money group is funding. So there's this organization called Chorus, which is this big influencer collective that launched in the wake of Kamala Harris's loss last fall. After Kamala Harris lost the election, I think a lot of Democrats did some soul searching and realized that they needed a better media strategy, that they had sort of ignored the podcast content creator industry, YouTubers, and they wanted to fix that problem, especially by working with, you know, internet content creators to get their message out. Chorus sprung up in November of 2024, and it launched initially as this public program. What was not public was this funding scheme that just recently launched in the past couple months. So Chorus is described in documents that we got as a project of the 1630 Fund, which is a dark money group, and they've been funneling thousands of dollars to influencers as part of this paid program in secret, basically. These influencers sign somewhat, I would argue, restrictive contracts that had specific restrictions on things that they could, you know, say in certain instances, people they could talk about. And also they weren't allowed to talk about the program itself. And so I wrote about this program and basically argue that this sort of dark money, which is shaping our political media ecosystem, is really corrosive.
Yeah, no, so there's a lot to unpack there. And I think one thing that we need to understand is the sort of the context. And, you know, this is the famous phrase that got hurled around after the election, you know, like, we need a liberal Joe Rogan. Where's our, you know, where's the liberal Joe Rogan? Which is, on one level is kind of ridiculous, but on another level does actually reflect a real reality, which is that, you know, like, there are many causes for Kamala Harris's election defeat. But one factor was that the Republicans, particularly J.D. Vance and President Trump, were very good at cultivating social media and going on podcasts and reaching a lot of sort of swing voters, particularly young voters, young men that had actually like voted for Joe Biden in 2020, but were receptive to this message. And this was in contrast to the on the Democratic Party side, where Kamala Harris was more reluctant to go on some of these podcasts, but also her campaign was much more controlling of her interactions with social media. And this is actually something you wrote a lot about last year when it was actually happening. And also, there's a conflict between the Democratic Party and social media influencers over politics. And so I think that's a crucial part of the story. Do you want to, like, just explain that context?
Yeah, I mean, the Democrats have for years struggled with the internet. Ironically, you know, Barack Obama came to power in part because his ability to leverage the internet back in 2008. And he did some early work with YouTubers in the 2010s. But 2015 on, it's been a real struggle. And I think that is due to a number of things. Like, Democrats really did miss this massive shift in media where the content creator industry was emerging and booming throughout the 2010s. And these online spaces, especially radicalized online spaces, were very effectively captured by the far right. And that is part of what brought Trump to power. I think back to 2016, I covered that election and was on the campaign trail and was in the Hilton the night that Trump won. And I looked around that night at the election night party, and it was a bunch of content creator like people, forum admins. The night before Trump's inauguration in 2017, there was the Deplorable, where all the biggest right-wing influencers got together. And, Mike Cernovich even credited social media with Trump's win. So I think that the MAGA movement has always been tightly intertwined with the podcast, YouTuber, internet, influencer world. Democrats have really instead preferred to work with traditional media. They like the top-down structure. They generally support institutions. And so they've really struggled to kind of speak to the broader internet. There's also the problem of the fact that pretty much any culturally relevant, popular content creator that's on the left is anti-establishment. So they're not fans of Joe Biden. They're not fans of Kamala Harris. They're fans of, I reported on this in 2020, more of like Bernie Sanders and these sort of anti-establishment, Zohran, Mamdani, you know, people that are a little bit further to the left. So after Kamala Harris's loss, like, they really have just tried to supercharge these programs where they're like, all right, we've ignored these influencers for too long. We've tried this top-down control. We booted Hassan Piker out of the DNC last year disastrously. Let's try to work with these people. And so you saw a bunch of this sort of like consultant class come in and donor money come in and set up these, you know, various programs.
Yeah. So I guess the sort of structural component of this is you have a political strategist and a donor class that is very heavily invested in old media and in the sort of tight control that you can get in old media. And but they know they need to get people in these new media spaces. And I think in your reporting, you also mentioned Gaza was a major factor in kind of like alienating a lot of social media influencers from the Democratic Party. So you know, like what happens when you get, people who like a lot of traditional media and control going into this space? But let's like lay out in terms of the type of money that we're talking about and also maybe the type of control that can best be seen in this sort of contract. So what were people being paid and what were they expected to do?
Yeah, so this 1630 Chorus program had about 90 influencers in it, and they were paid anywhere from as low as $250 a month to up to $8,000 a month for some of the bigger people and the most dedicated like defenders of the organization. And what they had to do is attend daily messaging check-ins, as they described messaging check-ins, which were sometimes led by this big YouTuber, Brian Tyler Cohen, who co-founded Chorus. And then they would have events with lawmakers. They would use that $8,000 a month to produce certain content, ideally to promote specific messaging. The restrictions that they signed were that they couldn't talk about it. They couldn't badmouth other people in the program. So for instance, if somebody does give misinformation about a war or something, like, you couldn't criticize them theoretically, according to this contract. And just a number of other provisions. For instance, they had to funnel the bookings with lawmakers or with political figures or anyone sort of any content that's affiliated with Chorus's policy agenda, they had to filter through Chorus. So if you got, for instance, one content creator told me, well, if I got an interview with Zohran, I have to now filter that through Chorus and this program. And so, you know, it just seems like a level of editorial control that certainly I as a journalist would never give. And I do think it's notable that some of the people in this program that are content creators, full-time content creators, have represented themselves as journalists while taking this dark money political, you know, as part of this political scheme.
Yeah.
And so that is the difference. One thing I should point out, because I do think that there's been a lot of like, a little bit of like misconstruing things online. nowhere in the article do we allege that they are given specific talking points. So they attend these messaging check-ins, they're given money, they're given access, and then it's like, create the content that you want, right? So they're not given these specific like things to read. But what I would explain to people is that's very rarely how political influence works. Like it is about sort of access and curation and being part of the in-group. You know, we've seen some content creators attack any of these other creators that have spoken out criticizing this program. So it's about sort of like promoting Democrat party messaging.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like the idea is to create a network of people online who kind of broadly share the same politics. And so who are some of these people that are involved? I recognize some of the names, but not others. And it'd be kind of useful to have a sense of where their politics are, what sort of space they occupy in the media world.
Yeah. So these are very establishment, like centrist Democrat people. Mm-hmm. We have Olivia Juliana, who's the right-leaning sort of centrist Gen Z influencer, who's done a bunch of abortion work as well in Texas. She actually spoke at the 2024 Democratic National Convention. Lauren Pietra, she's a former Playboy executive who turned herself into a political influencer. She hosts a podcast for Occupy Democrats. Barrett Adair, a content creator who runs an American Girl doll pro DNC meme account. Can't believe this stuff is real. Suzanne Lambert, who has called herself a Regina George liberal, and she kind of makes these like Mean Girls style videos, like attacking, you know, people. Sandra Jennings, who's a former TLC reality star. David Pakman, who hosts this big progressive show on YouTube. Lee McGowan, who goes by Politics Girl online. This guy, Too Raw, Too Real, who actually collaborated extensively with Kamala Harris on the campaign. And has been very aggressive. Many of these creators have been very aggressive in their attacks on the left. And so it's, you know, it's a slew of them. I was able to confirm a couple dozen of them, and we mentioned some of the more notable ones in the story. But there are a lot, you know, since my story came out, Chorus and the 1630 Fund have still not released the full roster of all the 90 influencers. So there are still influencers out there getting paid this Democrat dark money that, you know, that have not disclosed it.
Yeah. And in terms of the money, my understanding from your article is that there's a spectrum, like some people got paid a little bit more and some people less. But what is the range that we're talking about here?
It's about $250 a month, which is extremely low, to $8,000 a month, which is, you know, it's a decent amount of money. Certainly not for like some of these YouTube millionaires, but nearly $100,000.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's like a middle class salary in the United States. That is for doing social media.
I mean, like, for making, you know, totally.
If somebody gave me $100,000 to do American Girl memes all day, I might consider that. As you mentioned, I mean, I think one thing way to think about this is that it's not so much, you know, you want to influence these people, give them talking points, which is not something that you kind of say, but you're creating a network with a particular kind of slant. This is like a social network within the media world of people who are like aligned, aware of each other, and see each other as a kind of a group with a shared identity. And as you mentioned, you know, they're already kind of coming in with, I'd say, broadly centrist politics. I think in the reaction to your piece, some people said, well, no, I've criticized Chuck Schumer, or I've said stuff about Gaza. Which is, I think, perhaps true in some cases, but I don't think that is the critical of Chuck Schumer and speaking out on Gaza are not like the main, you know, identifying features.
Also, I think it's about how you speak out on Gaza too, right? Like there's certain criticisms that are allowed, and I think certain, you know, what the left has argued is it hasn't gone far enough. I think though, like the one big problem is that, not to interrupt, but like we don't actually know, like there's a lot of people looking at this class of influencers, looking at who's been, you know, outed basically, and making a lot of inferences saying, well, these people have not spoken on this issue, or here's how they've spoken on this issue. And I know that, you know, Chorus has tried to refute that and stuff. And what I would say to them is that if you feel like those characterizations are wrong, release the full roster so that we can accurately judge the commonalities between everyone in the program. Are there 30 secret leftists in the program? we haven't heard of it. You know, we haven't seen them, but maybe they're there. So why don't you be transparent?
Well, no, and that actually gets to, I think, what is the main finding of your piece, or the main reason why this is troubling, which is a secrecy, right? Mm-hmm. Like the fact is that this is like, you know, like a fair amount of money that's being pumped into the media space, you know, with people like making, you know, like decent salaries, or, you know, like the equivalent of a decent salary in addition to all the other money that they make. And we have like no idea who they are and also who's funding them. And like, so, to my point of view, you know, like, we all consume media. Like, you know, if someone's advertising in the New York Times or the New Yorker, then I know who's like advertising there, right? And if these are like public companies, I know who the owners are. If the, you know, like the New Yorker had a program where like its writers were being paid by like of a secret political dark money group, who we don't know who's funding it, for doing additional reporting, like, I think that would, like, raise questions. And as you said, the people who are doing this, some of them are presenting themselves to the world as journalists.
Exactly. And I think it's quite concerning. Like, I mean, aside from the criticism, even if this was the most centrist neoliberal program, whatever, right? Like, there are centrist neoliberal voters maybe that are not served by the entire rest of the media establishment. I don't know. Whatever. It's their prerogative to run that type of program. What I would say is that it needs to be done in a more transparent way, because not only is the money not transparent, they're taking money from this big dark money slush fund that, you know, I personally would feel uncomfortable taking money, not knowing where it comes from and kind of what the agenda is behind that money. But also that we don't have transparency, as you mentioned, in the political media ecosystem. So people are watching these people's videos, believing that they're covering the news as journalists, while they're part of a political influence operation and getting daily messaging check-ins and all of this other stuff. That to me, as somebody that covers a lot of sort of the erosion of trust in media and stuff like that, it is very concerning. And I think it's important to note that it's not illegal. A lot of people, since my article came out, well, isn't the FCC, like, can't they regulate this? Aren't they violating by not having like sponsored disclosure things? And unfortunately, I reached out to the FEC and the FCC. The FCC does not regulate like political speech on Instagram and things like that. And the FEC also is just like worlds behind. So the Brennan Center for Justice put out a great report on this, I think a year or two ago, about just like the lack of regulation in the political influencer space. This is sort of the Wild West. And a lot of political forces on the right have exploited that for years. Now Democrats are trying to exploit it, but I think we could use more regulation, you know, on this industry as a whole.
Yeah, no, and I think that's actually a fairly big kind of media story going back to the 80s of sort of like the deregulation of media and the, coupled with the sort of deregulation of campaign financing. So you do get, there's a lot of spaces for dark money. I mean, the fact that it's illegal, it's in some ways, you know, as the old saying goes, you know, the scandal is what's legal. But also, and one other thing in terms of context, because it has been raised, this is not, you know, unique to the Democrats, and that there's, in some ways, they're responding to this pre-existing condition where the Republicans spend a lot of time and I think money, and not just the Republican Party, but other forces. It was like a scandal months ago where what looks to be people working on behalf of the Russian government, or perhaps partially financed by people in Russia, giving money to influencers who are largely like right-wing populists in the United States. So, you know, like this is like a much broader problem. But I have to say, if you think it's a problem that, like, you know, the Koch brothers are, you know, secretly funding political activity and that people should know about it, then you should also be concerned about this. Like, it cuts all ways.
Yeah, I you know, I've heard this argument, and I talked to a fellow journalist who covers dark money, and we talked about this on my podcast this week, but, you know, that, oh, we've got to fight fire with fire, you know? Mm. And, you know, what she argues, and what I would argue as well, is that's a very losing game when the entire system is stacked against you. Democrats just simply do not have the level of billionaire funding that is on the right. And so they're sort of, what they're doing is they're eroding trust in the media institutions. They're eroding trust among democracy. I mean, we spoke to a couple experts for this story in politics and ethics and things. And one thing that they brought up is that, like, when you run these sort of secretive influence schemes and they get exposed, which they inevitably do, people lose trust in media. They don't know what to believe. And now they know they sort of can't believe some things, but they start to question everything. And it just erodes trust in our democratic system more generally. We should be working to get money out of politics. We should be working to end this dark money system. I think that's actually something that the Democrats should prioritize in order to stop giving the Republicans this unfair advantage. Another thing that the Republicans learned years ago is that it's better to do these programs out in the open. If you look at something like Turning Point USA, which this has been compared to, that's a big open program, right? Like the influencers that are part of it put Turning Point in their bio. They have these big hyped up like America Fest type events. So it's kind of strange to me that this program wasn't done in the open, because I actually think if these influencers had come out and said, listen, hey guys, I got a lot of money. You know, I got some money to talk about the things I care about. We're going to be trying to, like, I think some of their fans would have been supportive. But I think it's this like misleading the audience thing that is just not good for our media, trust in media.
Yeah, no. And actually, that gets me to like the next point I kind of wanted to make. Because I mean, like your initial article, like you broke news and this is like, you know, well worth knowing about. But I thought when I first read it that, you know, well, there's a very simple response that Chorus and these influencers could make, which is, oh, you know, we made a mistake. The lawyers were too active. You know how lawyers get with non-disclosure agreements. We should have been out in the open. And yeah, we're doing this. We're fighting fire with fire. The Republicans are doing this. We actually do need to have a network of people that support the Democratic Party on social media. And we've corrected the one problem with this, and let's move on. And I honestly think, like, if they had done that, you know, your story, as good as it was, would have just like died. It would have been like a 2-3 day thing. And that was not the response.
Right? Gee, what's so crazy to me that I still cannot figure out, and it boggles my mind, is that I've been working on this story for a couple months. I reached out to Chorus and the 1630 Fund and every single influencer mentioned in the story multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I reached out, and Chorus and 1630 knew everything in this story. They knew everything. They knew it was going to be a very critical story a month ago. I assumed that, and I actually was like planning for this, that they would call up the Washington Post or the New York Times and say, hey, we want to make an announcement about this exciting new funding program that we have that we're going to announce because we're so excited to talk about this and we'll give you access to some of these content creators, whatever. There's reporters that would happily run that story, like, wow, look, this new Democratic funding initiative. And it would have effectively sort of killed my story. And they didn't do that. And then the response since the story came out, they also haven't been transparent. Is that like, so it just makes me wonder, why are they so allergic to transparency? Like, it's shocking.
It is really startling. I mean, you know, as the cliche is, you know, the cover-up's worse than the crime. Well, I don't think there's so much a cover-up here, but I think the attempted cover-up or the attempted...
It's bizarre. The response.
So I want to actually, like, rehearse some of what the response is just so people know what we're talking about. One of which is that you suddenly saw some of these people like releasing statements, which are all like very similarly worded, saying, you know, well, this is the story has been debunked or thoroughly debunked, or, you know, like,
where?
Which is like, it's actually where
it
has
who?
Not. But exactly, the story has not been debunked. The other aspect, the one thing that they did was some of the people involved with the story did not give statements or talk to you at the time, but afterwards released statements to you and to Wired, and those were integrated into the piece. And that was used.
We added comment. That's all we did. This is a right-wing tactic. To refuse comment for weeks and weeks and weeks. And then the minute the story goes up, send your comment through so that you know that the journalist is going to act ethically and incorporate that comment into the piece, and then misrepresent that comment update as a correction. There are zero corrections on that story. That is like a MAGA thing.
No, it is exactly the sort of, you know, fake news, you know, tactic that, but not the only Trumpian thing. And I think there have been other people, notably Crystal Ball and Emma Vigeland, who have basically described the response to your piece as Trumpian. And I think that is exactly right, that it is, you know, using the tactics of the right. So we have the, you know, the pretense that it was debunked when it was not debunked, the addition of additional comments as a claim of correction when that's not a claim. There was the linkage, the attempted linkage, which I also found like particularly obscene. Cohen. Was it Cohen or Paxman who claimed that Candace Owen and Tucker Carlson were big fans of yours? And they took this quote out of context where they were sarcastically saying, well, you got to hand it to Taylor Lorenz. You know, at least she's honest about what she believes. And for listeners, I thought this was particularly bad because Tucker Carlson has, you know, like targeted you in very ugly ways in terms of doxing. So again, this sort of guilt by association with people that you're not even associated with, you know? But I would even add, like, even if you and Tucker Carlson were best friends and you were a MAGA person, if you wrote an article that was like, you know, fact-checked, vetted, had all, you know, all the right information, then, you know, like none of that would matter, right? So again, like just an absurd Trumpian type tactic.
I'm also doing a very public, very reputable investigative journalism fellowship right now. And they tried to compare my, like, again, very public, very well-disclosed investigative journalism fellowship to, like, their dark money scheme, despite the fact that my journalism fellowship is funded by one person and not dark money. Like, there's nothing that you, like, it's apples and oranges. The Tucker Carlson thing was especially egregious to me because, like you mentioned, he's targeted me so aggressively, and I've also reported quite critically on Candace Owens. I'm primarily known for reporting really critically on right-wing influencers. Like, some of my biggest stories have been on the right and the far right especially. So for these people to turn around and act.
Because what I heard was that you're friends with Tucker Carlson.
Right. Yeah. The person who got my parents swatted, you know, many times. It's very absurd. And also it's this thing where they also were accusing me of being a Russian plant and secret MAGA. And, you know, I think some of these liberals, like, I get that they are like, Trump is a threat to democracy. Nobody wants Trump in power on the left, right? Like, we all can agree on that. But this idea that anyone who writes anything even slightly critical of the Democrats is like helping MAGA is very delusional. I want the Democrats to run more effective influencer programs. I want more transparency in the political media space so that we can all trust our media and that, you know, we don't see the complete erosion of journalism. That only helps the right. Like, If people can't tell the difference between journalists and influencers, like content creators who are doing political schemes, that is not something that is going to help democratic norms. So I don't know what to tell these people other than, like, sometimes I criticize the Democrats, and I'm not even criticizing like all Democrats. It's really just this like one democratic scheme.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is a very curious thing. And I mean, we can only speculate like what's going on. But I mean, the intensity and I'd say the absurdity of the response, on the one hand, you could say, well, maybe it reflects that there's something more going on there. And I certainly hope there's more investigation of this. But it could also be like just a very brittle mindset. I mean, I think we saw some of this over the last few years. I mean, my experience was like, if you wrote about, say, Joe Biden's health, or wrote about Gaza, certainly you do get a certain segment of the party establishment that have a kind of brittle response, which is like, you know, while you're helping Trump, you're helping MAGA, or, you know, in the more extreme cases, you're a Russian asset. You're, you know, how much money is Putin paying you? For the nation is an old accusation of Russian gold.
I think what they're doing is so dangerous too, especially the way that they're attacking Wired, because most of their attacks are personal about me. But the reason I wrote this story for Wired is because Wired has done some of the best journalism out there on the intersection of technology and politics. I mean, their reporting on Doge has been phenomenal. They've broken major, major stories about the administration. And then you have these influencers getting online and saying, Wired lied. Wired is lying. Like, this is the lying media. And it really, I can't explain enough like how harmful that is. Like, I am a big critic of the mainstream media, huge. But to accuse these very journalistic outlets, especially one like Wired, which is pretty unimpeachable, of just lying, especially when they've provided zero evidence to counter it, they have not gotten a single correction on that story. I tell them they don't have to put out their contracts publicly if they don't want to, although I think they should. They could just provide any evidence to Wired, disproving any fact in my story. And they have been unable to do that. They have not provided a single piece of evidence that debunks even a single fact of the story.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is very bad for like kind of all the reasons that you mentioned. I also want to like, you know, it's something you have raised after your story in some of the interviews. But like, even if on the level of tactics, like how effective this is going to be is, I think worth raising. I mean, I think like everything that you say about like, you know, how it's bad for media, it's bad for democracy.
It's also just ineffective. It's also just not going to help.
But I mean,
them
I can
win.
See some sort of like Machiavellian, you know, political strategy. Like, okay, you care about those things. We want to like defeat the Republicans. We want to defeat Trump, and you know, this will help us win. And like, I actually like, you know, like
no.
To me, like looking at it, like I don't actually see how this helps you. Let's maybe unpack that. Like, why are we skeptical of this?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's just like the people that they chose for the program, they are people that are already speaking to the base and did so ineffectively throughout the entire campaign. Or like, rather, I guess they spoke very effectively to like this specific, like hyper loyal strain of people. But the Democrats have a problem, right? They have a problem reaching young men. They have a problem reaching like all these different demographic groups that have moved away from the Democrats in this most recent cycle. It is so unclear to me how any of this content, which is essentially just like sort of pro-Democrat establishment slop, like here I am with Chuck Schumer on my American Girl doll meme page, like we're besties, which is so crazy because that girl made this one video about Chuck Schumer stuff. And then I see in the comments, he actually voted against the policy. Like she made this promotional video and he turned around and voted against whatever it was that she was promoting. It's so silly. Like it's access journalism, but without the journalism. So it's just sort of like weird PR slop for the Democrats. And that just does not resonate. It doesn't resonate with independent voters. It doesn't resonate with some of these other groups that have moved away from the Democrats. So it's just not effective. And if you look at the content that they've been putting out as well, it's getting like no engagement. It's not performing well. So I think that their money, especially these donors that are pouring millions of dollars into the space, it would be more effective to use it. Like there are a million more effective ways to use their money than running a program like this. And I do think it's also interesting that some of these influencers that truly have zero cultural impact, they're like failed, you know, stand-up comedians and things like that, like that just, and no hate to anybody doing a creative career. I shouldn't frame it that way. I should say rather like, you know, just that have maybe failed to like really make an impact online even, right? Like some of them are quite small. Maybe they only have a couple hundred thousand followers and yet they're getting the most amount of money. Like they're in the maximum program with these big YouTubers. And I don't know why they're in that program other than they are some of the most vocal defenders of Chorus. And so it seems like they're creating this ecosystem of people that are sycophants. They're rewarding them by accepting them into these paid programs. And I have yet to see it do anything effective. You know, look at someone like Zohran, right? Who's generated such a massive online movement, so much excitement. There's left-leaning people across the country that are excited and energized by him, and content creators that are just making free content for him all day. They want to have him on the podcast. They want to have him on their shows. They want him on YouTube. They want to TikTok with him. He's not paying them. He doesn't have to run some influence. He just has popular policies and he's authentic. And I guess that's also what gets to the root of the issue, which is that the Democrats think that they have a messaging problem. And I would argue that they have a policy problem.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you said that, because I actually do think that that is the root issue here, that like, you know, like if you have, you know, if you build it, they will come. Well, if you have popular policies, then you'll get people excited. And thinking more broadly, I mean, something you said earlier about sort of the anti-establishment edge of the new social media, I think is really important to think about. You know, like basically going back to at least the global war on terror and the 2008 financial meltdown, you've had like, you know, this powerful turn of anti-system politics in the United States and throughout the world, really. And the media component of this has been a turn away from, you know, what is called old media, the sort of like establishment media that has the view from nowhere, that is, you know, like based on an idea of a shared objectivity that came from a consensus culture, towards these sort of like new social medias, which are based on like, you know, like personal relationship, authenticity, voice, and often have an anti-establishment edge. And as you mentioned, like, you know, like sometimes Democrats can harness that. I mean, certainly Barack Obama was able to do so by presenting himself as a break in the system. And then also, like, you know, like, it's kind of forgotten, but, like, you know, one of the first politicians to go on podcast was Obama, and he would go on, you know, Mark Maron and the sports podcast. But the other aspect is that a lot of these podcasts, like, they're not partisan in a narrow way. Like, they have a broader anti-system politics, but, you know, like, appeal to other things that people are interested in, you know, and a lot of them are on the right, also made by failed stand-up comedians.
We've got a lot of failed entertainers all over the media space.
I think that's a big part of, I mean, somebody should write a book about this. I mean, failed theater kids have, like, changed American politics. Like, really? This is just you know, something like Joe Rogan, like, you know, you listen to that. A lot of that is about, like, it's not about politics. It's about, like, UFOs and ancient astronauts and weirdo conspiracy theories and bodybuilding. And, you know, like, the Republicans were able to, you know, go to these things that were popular for other reasons, reaching people that don't pay attention to politics because they're talking about UFOs and bodybuilding and appeal to them. That's very different than, like, having, you know, like, a Chuck Schumer fan account podcast, you know, like, which is not gonna, like, reach anyone other than people already love that, you know, voted for the Democrats for the last 50 years.
Exactly. It's just, it's so tone deaf in this era too. And I think that that's what really, like, rubs people the wrong way. It's like, this is what the money is going to. And there are more effective projects out there. You know, like, there are other people. There's so much interest in, I do think, from the donor class. Teddy Schleifer at the New York Times had a great piece a little while ago about kind of some of these efforts. I think the thing is that most of the people engaged in these efforts are not media and entertainment people. They're not from the content creator industry. They've never worked in, like, online attention economy. They're fundamentally political consultants and political marketers, or people that do sort of, like, political campaigns. And they're sort of trying to come in and then do these, like, media projects, and they just don't understand the media landscape, and they don't understand online attention. And clearly, I would argue that it shows that they're not effective messengers when they had a critical article come out and they've made a 2-week story making everything worse, like, truly pouring gasoline on the fire. Like, how, you know, and your whole thing is that you're supposed to be effective messengers, like, and doing effective media. Like, you just, this is kind of a case study in how poorly you managed media. So, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of, like, a sort of competence issue. But I think reading your piece and, you know, thinking about this a bit more, there's a more fundamental structural thing, which goes to your point about, you know, the problem isn't the message, it's the policy. Like, if you have pro-establishment policies, if you have a pro-establishment worldview and, you know, pro-establishment agenda, then, you know, like, you know, like, I don't care how many memes you do, or, you know, like, how many people you pay on YouTube. Like, it's not going to resonate, you know, with a popular group that is very anti-establishment. And I would say, you know, like, in terms of fighting Trump, the anger against Trump is also an anti-establishment anger. Like, I mean, the best argument against Trump at this point is that this guy is the establishment.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, you know, like, the president, but he's getting, like, Harvard and the big law and the Pentagon, and everyone's cowering before him. So if you want to fight the man, Donald Trump is the man. But, like, you know, like, they don't want to argue Trump is the man. They want to say, like, Trump is a Russian asset or whatever.
Yeah.
So it's like on some fundamental level, like, I don't know if you have people that are so committed to, like, preserving the establishment or some sort of ancien regime restoration, like, you're going to be able to get any sort of message that resonates with people.
Well, you know what really concerns me, because I'm a tech reporter, right? And so, like, in addition to covering the influencer industry, I cover a lot of tech policy stuff. And this strain goes further than just their influencer media strategy. Like, the Democrats have actually backed very right-wing legislation recently, and continue to back these legal efforts to actually crack down on speech online. So the Republicans have never been the party of free speech. Like, this idea that Trump is free speech is a lie. Obviously, Elon Musk is certainly also not free speech. Like, this is the term that they co-opt and leverage. But what we've seen is the Democrats also basically get annoyed about people online and sort of speaking online, and they've been supporting laws like the Kids Online Safety Act or these state age verification laws that would basically established this top-down control of the internet that wouldn't allow for a free and open media ecosystem, that would actually devastate the careers of all these content creators. It's really regressive policy. It's really ineffective policy. It doesn't protect children. It doesn't crack down on big tech. It actually entrenches big tech's power. These laws are bad. These child safety is how they frame them. Of course, that's not what they do. These are really scary legal efforts that are brewing in the background. And so when I see the Democrats sort of messaging, like PR machine people, like these dark money people funding, like in one sense, they want to have this top-down control over the influencer space. And then on the back end, they're trying to regulate the internet in a way where they have more and more control. And I just think it's scary. Like I, you know, no one wants some free-for-all on the internet, right? Like we want to have safety precautions and things, but the laws that they're backing are really bad. And there are things that the Heritage Foundation, especially the Kids Online Safety Act, this is something that the Heritage Foundation has come out and said, we will use this if you pass this to censor LGBTQ people. We're already seeing reproductive justice content censored under this proactive age verification nonsense in places like Texas. So we should fight against, and I know no one wants to hear about bad, I try to make everything about tech policy, but like it is tied in with this bigger problem
Yeah, absolutely tied in exactly with people who are, you know, basically trying to shore up, you know, a failing establishment.
Yes.
And like, you know, regain the control, which they're not going to get. And in the process, alienating a lot of people and making things much worse.
And fundamentally eroding our civil liberties potentially as well.
Yeah. And creating a legal grounds for things getting much more repressive. So no, it's exactly on point. So, I mean, there's much more we could talk about all this, but it's a really rich conversation. And I want to thank Taylor once again, both for her article and for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great chatting.